This is Anglia Examinations, England. Listening Examination. Level 2. Paper AA Proficiency 124. Candidate Instructions. Listen to the recording and answer the questions. You will hear each part of the recording twice. There will be a pause before each part so you can read the questions. There will be other pauses to let you think about your answers. When you hear the tone, write your answers on the question paper. Write clearly in the spaces provided. Use a blue or black pen in the spaces provided. You must ask any questions now, as you cannot speak during the test. Listen to the first part of the test.
Section L1. You will hear a guide talking to visitors at the Château de Miromesnil, Normandy, France. For questions 1 to 4, listen to the recording and tick the correct box. For questions 5 to 12, fill in the missing information.
Hello and welcome to the Château de Miromesnil. Hopefully the weather will clear up before we go round the park. As you can see just looking at the château, it's a very typical pre-revolutionary nobleman's residence. The original 12th century castle that was on the site was badly damaged by the forces of Henri IV in 1589, and it was destroyed and rebuilt as a château many years later. Some of the decoration dates from the 19th century, but don't be fooled, it's a typical French 17th century mansion, of which there are many in this part of France. The family of writer Guy de Maupassant has a strong connection to the château. Its 19th century owners had no heirs to leave it to, or any need to be in it themselves. So they let it out, and Guy de Maupassant's parents were the people who rented it from them. This is Guy de Maupassant's birthplace. He was born here in 1850. We're really proud of that close link to the famous writer. Although he was only here for a few years, he spent his youth in the local area. As a young man, he moved to Rouen and then spent most of his life in Paris. But we know that he always had very warm memories of this place where he used to live. Now, if we just go outside, we come immediately to the walled garden. It was developed after the Second World War primarily as a source of food, but the present owners have made it a special feature as it is set out in the style of a perfect English kitchen garden, drawing visitors not only from the local area, but also all over the world. All kinds of vegetables were grown here and still are. They are used by the château for its award-winning restaurant and are exclusively for this purpose. There used to be dangerous wild animals roaming around here when the château was built. In the park, you can still see the remains of a ditch around the château, which was designed to keep them out. What you can see here is a park once presented in a formal French style but redesigned in the 18th century in the then very fashionable English style. It is supposed to be more natural and less formal. A metro station in Paris was opened in 1923 and was named in honour of the aristocrat called the Marquis de Miromesnil, using the place name for its own name. He was the owner here in the 1780s and was one of Louis XVI's ministers. He was very lucky, actually. He was arrested in 1793 by the revolutionaries, but soon after, Robespierre, the leader of the revolution, died. The revolution then collapsed and the Marquis was freed. Now, before we go round the house itself, I'd like to tell you a little about our upcoming Maupassant Festival. It's going to be a whole day celebrating the life and works of the writer. It'll be on Saturday, June the 21st, starting at 10 o'clock in the morning and finishing at 4 in the afternoon. Entry to the festival is free, but we are hoping you may care to make a donation of about €10 to help cover the costs of hosting the festival for the Maupassant Society. There are going to be events held here in the South Garden and in the ballroom of the house itself. Over 40 films based on stories by Maupassant have been made, and we'll be showing a selection in the ballroom. We have a large number of authentic 1880s costumes, both male and female, which guests will be allowed to try on. And we're hoping that most visitors do this to get themselves into the spirit of the day. Of course, a lot depends on the weather, but we will have a number of tents in the park should it rain. And local actors will be reading both the poetry and the stories of Maupassant. You don't need to bring anything except perhaps a raincoat. Bring a packed lunch if you want, but our restaurant tent will be providing delicious food at reasonable prices. Now, step with me this way and I'll show you something else.
Now listen to the first part of the test again.
Hello and welcome to the Château de Miromesnil. Hopefully the weather will clear up before we go round the park. As you can see just looking at the chateau, it's a very typical pre-revolutionary nobleman's residence. The original 12th century castle that was on the site was badly damaged by the forces of Henri IV in 1589, and it was destroyed and rebuilt as a chateau many years later. Some of the decoration dates from the 19th century, but don't be fooled, it's a typical French 17th century mansion, of which there are many in this part of France. The family of writer Guy de Maupassant has a strong connection to the chateau. Its 19th century owners had no heirs to leave it to, or any need to be in it themselves. So they let it out, and Guy de Maupassant's parents were the people who rented it from them. This is Guy de Maupassant's birthplace. He was born here in 1850. We're really proud of that close link to the famous writer. Although he was only here for a few years, he spent his youth in the local area. As a young man, he moved to Rouen and then spent most of his life in Paris. But we know that he always had very warm memories of this place where he used to live. Now, if we just go outside, we come immediately to the walled garden. It was developed after the Second World War primarily as a source of food, but the present owners have made it a special feature as it is set out in the style of a perfect English kitchen garden, drawing visitors not only from the local area, but also all over the world. All kinds of vegetables were grown here and still are. They are used by the chateau for its award-winning restaurant and are exclusively for this purpose. There used to be dangerous wild animals roaming around here when the chateau was built. In the park, you can still see the remains of a ditch around the chateau, which was designed to keep them out. What you can see here is a park once presented in a formal French style but redesigned in the 18th century in the then very fashionable English style. It is supposed to be more natural and less formal. A metro station in Paris was opened in 1923 and was named in honour of the aristocrat called the Marquis de Miromesnil, using the place name for its own name. He was the owner here in the 1780s, and was one of Louis XVI's ministers. He was very lucky, actually. He was arrested in 1793 by the revolutionaries, but soon after, Robespierre, the leader of the revolution, died. The revolution then collapsed, and the Marquis was freed. Now, before we go round the house itself, I'd like to tell you a little about our upcoming Maupassant Festival. It's going to be a whole day celebrating the life and works of the writer. It'll be on Saturday, June the 21st, starting at 10 o'clock in the morning and finishing at 4 in the afternoon. Entry to the festival is free, but we are hoping you may care to make a donation of about 10 euros to help cover the costs of hosting the festival for the Maupassant Society. There are going to be events held here in the South Garden and in the ballroom of the house itself. Over 40 films based on stories by Maupassant have been made, and we'll be showing a selection in the ballroom. We have a large number of authentic 1880s costumes, both male and female, which guests will be allowed to try on, and we're hoping that most visitors do this to get themselves into the spirit of the day. Of course, a lot depends on the weather, but we will have a number of tents in the park should it rain, and local actors will be reading both the poetry and the stories of Maupassant. You don't need to bring anything except perhaps a raincoat. Bring a packed lunch if you want, but our restaurant tent will be providing delicious food at reasonable prices. Now, step with me this way and I'll show you something else. Now listen to the second part of the test. Section L2. You are going to hear four speakers talking about pets. For questions 1 to 8, choose the correct answer, A, B, C or D. Speaker 1.
I've heard it said a lot that pets can help children be more responsible. I have yet to see that in my son, though. Bill was frankly a bit wild and was always running around all the time, and the dog seems to have done its job in bringing him back to earth. I had some empathy with him, as I was like that at his age, and wish I'd had a dog. Bill's really calmed down now. He's still a little lonely, but we're hopeful in the future that the dog will help him connect with other children too. Bill's sister Janet doesn't really like the dog because she's afraid of it, I think. It's called Treacle, by the way. So that's not very good, but we're working on it. My wife adores Treacle, which is perhaps just as well. And as for me, well, I have a complicated relationship with it. I mean, I love it, but sometimes it can be a bit of a nuisance, if that's not too mean to say.
Speaker 2.
Rabbits are always seen as ideal pets for children, but I'm not sure. Some of them can apparently be quite affectionate. You can have them hopping around the house and they're fine, though you might find the odd wire chewed, I suppose. They're pretty straightforward to look after, which is a bonus. What isn't widely known is that some of them can act out of their supposedly cute and friendly character. My daughter Emma had to have treatment after her rabbit bit her quite seriously. It might look cute, but looks can be very misleading. We had a drama down at the vet's with Thumper, Emma's rabbit, last week. He was just having a routine injection, but I was worried he'd scratch the vet by mistake or something. He's quite a character. Anyway, Emma took him out of his basket and he jumped down and ran out of the door chased by this enormous dog. It didn't catch him, but neither did we for about 20 minutes.
Speaker 3. I love cats, and if I could, I'd have a dozen of them. I've had all kinds. Siamese, Maine Coon, Persian, and lots of ordinary tabbies. The pedigree breeds, like the Siamese, can be so beautiful to look at, but they often have behavioural issues. Saying that, the Persian was my favourite for a long time. However, eventually the tabby replaced the Persian as my number one. Maybe it's because they're an easy and classic choice. Anyway, I had a Maine Coon once that just stared at me all the time. It was rather disturbing, although it was a really beautiful animal. I had a row with my neighbour last week. He was furious because my cat had dug up his garden and ruined some plants. I tried apologising, but he kept shouting at me, so I could hardly get a word in. Then I had a brainwave, and I got out my wallet, and I handed him a few notes as a goodwill gesture. He stopped immediately and became very friendly. Whether he spent it on new plants, I'll probably never know. People have suggested keeping the cat indoors, which seems a bit extreme. As it turned out, the answer was quite simple. Speaker 4.
I bought an African grey parrot for a bit of company. It wasn't a young bird, but the man who sold it to me said it was a good talker, didn't swear or make rude comments, and also that it was very gentle if a bit messy. Well, in fairness, most of that was true. It was very gentle and affectionate, and though it threw its food around the room a bit, it wasn't unduly messy. But I couldn't get a word out of it, which I would argue is the novelty of owning a parrot. I suppose that certainly meant it didn't offend anyone, but a mute parrot is not what I had in mind. I tried to sell it to a pet shop, but the owner said he'd bought some like mine before, and it had been a terrible mistake, and now he only bought very young parrots. In the end, a neighbour of mine who teaches art advertised it on the college notice board. It took a while, but eventually one of his students contacted me. Within a week, my parrot had gone to a new home.
Now listen to the second part of the test again. Speaker 1.
I've heard it said a lot that pets can help children be more responsible. I have yet to see that in my son, though. Bill was frankly a bit wild and was always running around all the time, and the dog seems to have done its job in bringing him back to earth. I had some empathy with him, as I was like that at his age, and wish I'd had a dog. Bill's really calmed down now. He's still a little lonely, but we're hopeful in the future that the dog will help him connect with other children too. Bill's sister Janet doesn't really like the dog because she's afraid of it, I think. It's called Treacle, by the way. So that's not very good, but we're working on it. My wife adores Treacle, which is perhaps just as well, and as for me, well, I have a complicated relationship with it. I mean, I love it, but sometimes it can be a bit of a nuisance, if that's not too mean to say.
Speaker 2.
Rabbits are always seen as ideal pets for children, but I'm not sure. Some of them can apparently be quite affectionate. You can have them hopping around the house and they're fine, though you might find the odd wire chewed, I suppose. They're pretty straightforward to look after, which is a bonus. What isn't widely known is that some of them can act out of their supposedly cute and friendly character. My daughter Emma had to have treatment after her rabbit bit her quite seriously. It might look cute, but looks can be very misleading. We had a drama down at the vet's with Thumper, Emma's rabbit, last week. He was just having a routine injection, but I was worried he'd scratch the vet by mistake or something. He's quite a character. Anyway, Emma took him out of his basket and he jumped down and ran out of the door chased by this enormous dog. It didn't catch him, but neither did we for about 20 minutes.
Speaker 3.
I love cats, and if I could, I'd have a dozen of them. I've had all kinds. Siamese, Maine Coon, Persian, and lots of ordinary tabbies. The pedigree breeds, like the Siamese, can be so beautiful to look at, but they often have behavioural issues. Saying that, the Persian was my favourite for a long time. However, eventually the tabby replaced the Persian as my number one. Maybe it's because they're an easy and classic choice. Anyway, I had a Maine Coon once that just stared at me all the time. It was rather disturbing, although it was a really beautiful animal. I had a row with my neighbour last week. He was furious because my cat had dug up his garden and ruined some plants. I tried apologising, but he kept shouting at me, so I could hardly get a word in. Then I had a brainwave, and I got out my wallet, and I handed him a few notes as a goodwill gesture. He stopped immediately and became very friendly. Whether he spent it on new plants, I'll probably never know. People have suggested keeping the cat indoors, which seems a bit extreme. As it turned out, the answer was quite simple.
Speaker 4.
I bought an African grey parrot for a bit of company. It wasn't a young bird, but the man who sold it to me said it was a good talker, didn't swear or make rude comments, and also that it was very gentle, if a bit messy. Well, in fairness, most of that was true. It was very gentle and affectionate, and though it threw its food around the room a bit, It wasn't unduly messy. But I couldn't get a word out of it, which I would argue is the novelty of owning a parrot. I suppose that certainly meant it didn't offend anyone, but a mute parrot is not what I had in mind. I tried to sell it to a pet shop, but the owner said he'd bought some like mine before, and it had been a terrible mistake, and now he only bought very young parrots. In the end, a neighbour of mine who teaches art advertised it on the college notice board. It took a while, but eventually one of his students contacted me. Within a week, my parrot had gone to a new home.
Now listen to the third part of the test. Section L3. You are going to listen to part of an interview with TV conservationist Simon Walton. Answer all the questions below by marking the correct box with a tick.
So, Simon, how did your successful media career in conservation come about?
Well, as everyone knows, I was campaigning against the pheasant shooting industry and glued myself to the street outside a shooting estate headquarters. I was interviewed while glued by 13 different TV companies. I couldn't avoid them, and my anti-shooting message just got more fluent as I repeated it. It got picked up by ARG TV, and they gave me my own show, Simon Says It.
A show? Well, it was just a 2-minute slot at 11 p.m. on Monday nights, wasn't it?
True, but it developed a cult following, and I was asked to speak at conferences and at demonstrations.
And I understand a conference is where you met your wife.
Ah, you've been doing your research. I did, yes, in Scotland, though we discovered when we got talking that we'd been to the same school in different years and never even noticed each other, and even on the same demonstration 2 years before, when we didn't notice each other either.
Indeed. Now, I must ask you this because I'm really interested. I understand there's a bus named after you in Brighton. How?
Well, someone nominated me for the honour, after which there's a vote in the city. It's a tremendous honour. I think people think you can pay for it like an advertisement, or the bus company just choose who they want. But it's more of a process than that.
Well, back to conservation. We hear so much these days about the threats to our planet. What do you think is the greatest menace?
Well, there are too many people. That's the basic problem we all have to face. Other issues like habitat destruction are results, not causes. We need to get to the root cause, as that's the source of the threat. Another result, of course, is global warming. I don't think the cause is acknowledged enough. We don't want to know that we're the problem. We want to think it's external to us, like the weather or nature itself that's failing.
And you think it's important to be open about problems, don't you?
That's right. I've had quite a few over the years. A lot of people are aware I've suffered with my mental health. This came to a head in 2013. I'd had depression for a while by then and had talked about it previously to raise awareness. That same year, I announced I had serious pneumonia, followed in 2015 by a virus causing a short period of blindness. All are now resolved. I feel very lucky, in fact. I'm happy to say that since 2020, I've been free of all of these.
Well, thank you, Simon, for your time and for your very candid answers.
Now listen to the third part of the test again.
So, Simon, how did your successful media career in conservation come about?
Well, as everyone knows, I was campaigning against the pheasant shooting industry and glued myself to the street outside a shooting estate headquarters. I was interviewed while glued by 13 different TV companies. I couldn't avoid them, and my anti-shooting message just got more fluent as I repeated it. It got picked up by ARG TV, and they gave me my own show, Simon Says It.
A show? Well, it was just a 2-minute slot at 11 p.m. on Monday nights, wasn't it?
True, But it developed a cult following, and I was asked to speak at conferences and at demonstrations.
And I understand a conference is where you met your wife.
Ah, you've been doing your research. I did, yes, in Scotland, though we discovered when we got talking that we'd been to the same school in different years and never even noticed each other, and even on the same demonstration 2 years before, when we didn't notice each other either.
Indeed. Now, I must ask you this because I'm really interested. I understand there's a bus named after you in Brighton. How?
Well, someone nominated me for the honour, after which there's a vote in the city. It's a tremendous honour. I think people think you can pay for it like an advertisement, or the bus company just choose who they want. But it's more of a process than that.
Well, back to conservation. We hear so much these days about the threats to our planet. What do you think is the greatest menace?
Well, there are too many people. That's the basic problem we all have to face. Other issues like habitat destruction are results, not causes. We need to get to the root cause, as that's the source of the threat. Another result, of course, is global warming. I don't think the cause is acknowledged enough. We don't want to know that we're the problem. We want to think it's external to us, like the weather or nature itself that's failing.
And you think it's important to be open about problems, don't you?
That's right. I've had quite a few over the years. A lot of people are aware I've suffered with my mental health. This came to a head in 2013. I'd had depression for a while by then and had talked about it previously to raise awareness. That same year, I announced I had serious pneumonia, followed in 2015 by a virus causing a short period of blindness. All are now resolved. I feel very lucky, in fact. I'm happy to say that since 2020, I've been free of all of these.
Well, thank you, Simon, for your time and for your very candid answers.
That is the end of the listening test. You will now have 3 minutes to check your answers. Your listening paper will then be collected.